But right now, I do believe that we have Mark on the line. Mark, are you there?
Yep.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. How are you doing?
Doing pretty well. How about you, Darren?
Very good. I wanted to talk to you about a bunch of stuff, but I'd like to start with the one that kind of corresponds with a whole bunch of my headlines and was sort of one of the main reasons we wanted to talk to you today, which was you were in D.C. for the most recent round of protests for Keystone XL.
Yeah, last weekend.
Sure. Do you want to just describe a little bit of it, just in case people aren't entirely on the ball with what was going on there? Do you want to just describe what was happening before I ask you a couple questions?
Yeah, sure. So it was a Keystone protest for sure, but it was also just to urge President Obama to move forward on climate. So that was one of his campaign slogans, was forward. And 350.org and the Sierra Club and other organizations are pushing him hard now to move forward on climate change. And of course, he made reference to that in his inaugural address a couple weeks ago, dedicating quite a substantial portion of his speech to action on climate change. So now there's really a strong and broad movement ramping up to try to pressure President Obama to actually take some concrete action, and one of those actions would include denying the permit to build the Keystone XL pipeline.
All right. So my first question with regards to that is that we did have an interview a little while ago with somebody from the Canadian, which is another environmental aggregator site for environmental news here in Canada. And his perspective on that was that doing things like fighting individual pipelines was potentially a waste of time because it doesn't deal with the bigger issues, and a whole lot of sort of energy and investment goes into them. And then even if you succeed, it's a very minor victory. Obviously, you made the trip down there, so you thought it was worth your time. But could you just comment on that idea? Do you think that protesting individual projects like this is something that really is going to critically lead to further change?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's symbolic. You know, if you look at that one pipeline, say, okay, well, how much difference will this make in the big picture? Is this going to solve the climate crisis? No, it's not. It's a symbolic gesture, and it would be, you know, quite remarkable, really, if President Obama were to deny this. It would send a message, and I think that's what climate activists are going for, is that he needs to send a message that he's serious about this issue, and he said just as much. So it's I mean, if you look at the emissions and the additional exploitation of the tar sands that's going to result from Keystone XL in terms of global warming, it's a small percentage. But the idea is that we have to be leaving these fossil fuels in the ground. And this is something that U.S. climate activists can actually have an effect on. And it's part of a larger campaign. It would be a huge symbolic victory. And it would make a difference in terms of the momentum for the movement moving forward to try to stop other coal projects and fracking and other pipelines that are going to be proposed and are being proposed for further tar sands exploitation.
Absolutely. So I think one of the other things I've got, you've actually spawned way too many ideas in my head, so I'm going to try and sort them all out. I have so many questions about this to get your perspective on. One of them is that one of the attitudes, I watch a lot of American political coverage, and one of the sentiments from a lot of the progressive commentators and stuff that we get is that sometimes in the U.S. there's I think this issue applies to Canada, but if, you know, for the time being we're talking about the U.S. Is that in American politics, a lot of people, it's so polarized, the political system, and as far as there being sort of two parties, and you're either in, you know, one camp or you're in the other camp, that a lot of the time a lot of people feel like it's difficult to criticize President Obama as a liberal because people assume that if you're not with the president, you're against him. Has that aspect played into this a lot? Have you found it difficult to get people on board with actually protesting a president that they themselves voted for?
You mean is it difficult for liberals to?
I guess, yeah. Like, has there been any trouble where people are like, yeah, I know it's not great, but I don't like the idea of being opposed to the president that I support?
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think that's an issue for people because, you know, he has actively sought out the support of the environmental movement, and so people are you know, holding his feet to the fire to a certain extent, saying, okay, we gave you our support twice, you disappointed us the first time around for the first 4 years, and we're going to give you another shot at this, and you've your words have indicated that you are serious about the climate change problem, that this is an issue for future generations, that we have a moral responsibility to do something about this, and for people living around the climate, a lot of people who are going to be most impacted from this, and this, of course, that we're talking about developing and poor nations to a large extent, but also rich countries as well, and of course, an obligation to future generations that we have to take this issue extremely seriously. We know what the science is telling us. There's an overwhelming judgment of science that this is perhaps the most urgent issue of the 21st century, certainly of our generation. And so, you know, I think that climate activists and environmentalists are saying, listen, we support you, and we're holding you true to your word, and we expect you to do something about this. And if you're not true to your word, as you said you're going to be, then they're going to push. They're going to fight, and we're going to see more of that.
All right. Now, so speaking on that, carrying on that theme, there was an article from Wednesday, February 20th in The Guardian talking about the pipeline. It was quoting Alex Purbakes, the TransCanada's president for oil and energy pipelines. He was quoted as saying, you could shut down oil sands production tomorrow and it would have absolutely no measurable effect on climate change. I'm just wondering if, before we get into that a little bit further, if you wanted to comment.
Yeah, I mean,
is this really a big deal? I mean, I know you said that it was, you know, a landmark as far as support.
Yeah.
Is actually shutting down this pipeline going to do anything? I mean, he was saying that shutting down the entire oil sands wouldn't do anything. So if you just comment on that.
I mean, first of all, it's not true. I mean, it's
that's the easy answer.
You know, it's this argument that a lot of fossil fuel advocates or oil industry representatives will use and say that, well, if we, you know, the tar sands, it's only a small percentage of global emissions, and unless we do something about China and the coal plants there, then it won't make any difference. But it's this argument as if to suggest that, you know, this is a problem of multiple sources, and any one source contributes to this problem. And so, yes, we have to also deal with coal plants. Yes, we have to deal with fracking. We have to deal with all sorts of emission sources, but one of them is tar sands, and to suggest that it makes no difference on climate change is simply not true. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know for a fact that the tar sands are Canada's largest single source of emissions. So if Canada is serious in any way, and our federal government has shown no interest in this file, but if we were to be actually serious about dealing with climate change and doing our moral and taking our moral responsibility to do something about our carbon emissions in this country, we have to deal with the tar sands. We have to deal with the emissions coming from the single largest source in Canada by far. And it's growing at a rapid rate. And with these new pipelines that are being proposed, if they come online, it's just going to increase exponentially. So it would make, if the tar sands were to be shut down tomorrow, which is not going to happen, and nobody's really even asking or expecting that to happen, it would make a huge dent in Canada's emissions. But again, what we're looking for, I think, is to actually have a plan to reduce emissions from the tar sands and to put the brakes on this massive industrial project. So I think it's morally irresponsible to make the argument that, oh, the tar sands is just one source of emissions, and in the global scheme of things, it makes no difference, when clearly that's not the case. And we know from science, and a lot of research has been done, in fact, that tar sands, the full exploitation of the tar sands, there was a report that came out a couple months ago by Andrew Weaver at the University of Victoria saying that he calculated that the tar sands, the full exploitation of the tar sands would result in almost 0.4 degrees of warming globally. And it doesn't sound like much, but since the Industrial Revolution, we've only seen 0.8 degrees of warming, okay? So, and the result of that has been all the extreme weather we've been witnessing around the world, droughts and floods and hurricanes, superstorms, you name it. So the tar sands would contribute another 0.4 degrees of warming. That is significant, if we were to exploit the tar sands completely. And there's every indication that that is, in fact, the intention of the governments of Alberta and the federal government of Canada to exploit the tar sands as completely and as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I think one of the Bill McKibben, of course, from 350.org, was 350 was very much involved with the Keystone protests, very much a catalyst for that in a lot of ways, especially the last one and then this one as well. And one of the sort of soundbite, Bill McKibben's very, very good at sort of condensing ideas and sort of making his arguments into soundbites. And one of them that I thought was very to the point on that was, why are we even talking about digging up more oil when science tells us that we can't afford to burn the oil we've already got?
Yeah.
Well, that's simple.
that's right, and that's a really key point. He actually did some of the calculations on how much fossil fuel reserves remain, known reserves around the world, and then compared that to this ubiquitous 2-degree target that we hear about, that the planet cannot afford. Climate scientists tell us that we cannot afford any more than 2 degrees of warming. And as I say, we already have 0.8 degrees of warming. We've already experienced 0.8 degrees since we started burning fossil fuels. So we have 1.2 degrees of wiggle room. And if we exploit all the known fossil fuel reserves around the planet, we would vastly overshoot that 2-degree target. So based on the calculations he did, he figures that we can only exploit about 1/5 of remaining fossil fuel known reserves. And that means that most of the fossil fuel, most of the oil and gas, most of the coal has to remain in the ground. And that's why campaigns such as the Keystone XL campaign and campaigns to slow down exploitation of the tar sands are so important, because it is a vast source of carbon. James Hansen has called the tar sands a carbon bomb, and building pipelines from the tar sands are like fuses to this carbon bomb.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even the quote there further down the article from the same guy from TransCanada was saying, you know, simple math tells us, therefore, that the oil sands represent only 0.1% of the global greenhouse emissions. But, I mean, a lot of this is sort of part of that trouble with numbers. People throw around numbers a lot. And in that case, the trouble with those numbers that he's using, aside from the fact that he's fudged a whole bunch of the numbers, I mean, even if you grant him his bad math, is that that's only dealing with the actual extraction of the tar from the tar sands, dealing with transportation, not dealing with refining, not dealing with it being burned as fuel in cars, mm-hmm. or any of that stuff. So
yeah, exactly.
You know, people have to be aware of the fact that 0.1%, when we're talking about, you know, the climate, is actually a massive number. It sounds small, but it's a massive, massive impact.
Yeah.
But it's also the numbers aren't true.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. I mean, when you reduce an enormous number down to 100, which is effectively what you're doing when you're making it a percentage, it sounds like a really small number when you know. But that percentage is actually in emissions terms, in megatons of carbon, is enormous. And you often hear that argument used in Canada and saying, well, tar sands only account for 6.5% of Canada's emissions. It doesn't sound like very much. By the way, that's rising rapidly. Mm-hmm. But by last count, it was about 6.5% of Canada's emissions. And you think, well, that's not a very big number. But, as I said, it is the single largest source of Canadian emissions. And 6.5% as a single source is enormous, if you think about it. I mean, that is more, if you think about how many cars and trucks are out on the road, the buildings that we heat, all the transportation fuel we need, all the ways in which we use fossil fuels, one single source in Canada is responsible for 6.5% of our total emissions. And so, yeah, you have to always be a little bit leery when you hear these percentages. And as you say, you point out very well, Darren, how are these numbers calculated? Are they including the so-called well-to-wheel emissions, or is it just the exploitation of the tar sands, but not the actual burning of the fuel in the gas tank, and so on?
Yeah, I just another way to sort of have fun with numbers around that too is people, again, if we say we grant him all of his math and that a 0.1% is actually accurate, context is everything. And the example I came up with that was, if somebody came up to you and offered, said, I'm going to give you 0.1% of my yearly income to do my job for me, you'd be like, that's a terrible deal. But then you find out that the guy's Bill Gates and his job is sitting on a yacht, and all of a sudden it's an amazing deal.
Yeah,
right? So context is absolutely everything.
It's a great point. Suddenly that 0.1% translates into several million dollars or something.
Yeah, exactly. So we can leave that behind for a little bit. You've been up to a lot more than just going to the Keystone protest. We've been out of touch for a little while, so it's not even like a bait question. I don't even know what you're going to say, but if you want to just tell us a little bit, people who maybe haven't been listening to the show for a long time don't know about Earth Gauge. If you want to just tell them a little bit about that project and what you've been up to?
Yeah, absolutely. So we worked together a little bit when I was doing some environmental programming at CKUT in Montreal, and since then I moved to Ottawa. And I was given an opportunity to host and produce an environment program on CKCU at Carleton. And so I'm doing that now, and it's been going really well. And that's Thursday mornings. I do an environment show, which, as you mentioned, is somewhat similar to what you guys, the great work you're doing on the Green Majority. But it is a little bit more Ottawa-focused, so we have a lot of local environmental stories. And, of course, being the capital of Canada, we have the political dimension. We managed to get some politicians on the show here and there and talk about federal environmental regulations and that kind of thing.
So one of the things I was noticing this morning, I was reading to you from one of the Guardian articles that that was quoting TransCanada boss a lot. There was a whole bunch of them that we found for this week's show, and I actually got quite irritated when I was reading them, but in the way that reminds me why I do this show, and I wanted your comment on it as well, because I know you read a lot of news, probably more than I do, to be honest.
I don't know about that.
But as far as the environment stuff, and one of the things that just it frustrates me and then reminds me why I do the show, which is that even when there's the journalist is attempting to do a fair story or attempting to even do a positive story for the environment, environmental reporting in the traditional media is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely terrible. And I just, like, there's even one, I'm going to post it online. I won't take up a whole bunch of time by trying to paraphrase an article that I hated, but it really didn't seem like the journalist, I'm not going to out them on air. You can check the website if you're interested in what I'm referring to. I'll post it and make a note of it on the website afterwards, but it's just bad. They're, you know, misunderstanding concepts, using sort of what I find that happens a lot in the news is that unbeknownst to the journalist, they'll take sort of oil industry or lobbyist talking points about the environmentalists' points of view, not realizing that it's sort of, you know, it's the point of view as given to you by the opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. And it just really frustrates me. So I know you read just as much news as I do, probably. So it just, if you want to comment on that at all about sort of where you feel having over the past few years, the sort of state of environmental reporting, do you get the same feeling that I do? Do you get frustrated when you read the news?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's particularly when it comes to climate change. I don't know if what you're referring to was a climate change.
It was actually specifically about the Keystone, but I just mean like in a general sense.
Yeah, I mean, I share your same frustration. I think for whatever reason, I'm not suggesting it's intentional, but some of the environment reporting is leaves a lot to be desired, let's put it that way. And some of it is just incorrect. And you know, there's always this tendency in journalism or this desire to present both sides of the story, and that becomes, for an issue like climate change, it becomes incredibly frustrating because, you know, I did an interview for last week's show with Dr. Eric Galbraith of McGill University. He's a climate scientist. And, you know, he was expressing a lot of these same frustrations. And I asked him, why does there seem to be this ongoing debate in the media about climate science and the fact that whether or not the world is warming and humans are responsible? And he said, you know what, it's beyond my capacity to understand. I go to these climate conferences on a regular basis, and there is no disagreement among climate scientists. There's no real disagreement. Sure, there is some debate about what the impacts might be, how much warming we're going to witness, but the fact that warming is happening, the fact that humans are to blame, is just accepted fact. And that's saying something, because these are scientists who, by they tend to be skeptical by nature. They tend to disagree with each other. But on this particular issue, there's virtually no disagreement. But you would not know that by reading about climate change in particular, but also some other environmental issues. You would not necessarily know or get that feeling from reading these stories in the media. So it is, it can be certainly frustrating. And it just means that, you know, the important work that your show is doing in trying to tell people the truth of what's actually going on.
Mm. Well, there's a lot of people may not realize, just I think it makes a very interesting comparison, is that there actually is, you can look it up, there actually is in 2013, the educated North American people who are part of what's called a Flat Earth Society, where they think that all science is not, you know, this is all, we've all been deceived and the Earth is actually still flat. These people actually
yeah,
do right. exist. So there was a comment by one of my favorite commentators who said that showing both sides of the climate change debate is no more to the point than just saying to both sides to the gravity debate.
Yeah.
Yes, you will find someone who doesn't agree, but that doesn't mean they're worth listening to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a valid comparison. I mean, there are still people out there who, you know, probably believe the Earth is flat, but there are certainly people who believe the Earth is only 6,000 years old. I mean, that there's no question about that. They completely reject the theory of evolution. So, you know, you're just not going to convince everybody. And on climate change, there are always going to be people who just won't believe it. And you can present them with any amount of science and any amount of evidence, and they simply won't believe it for whatever reason. So, but the media have a responsibility to report to report what we know, and what we know is very clear. There is no debate, and the climate scientists are telling us that we have to take this issue seriously and act urgently, and we're simply not doing that. And I think, you know, I don't want to say the media are responsible for our inaction. Clearly, that's not the case, but I think we could be doing a much better job at letting people know that there's very little debate in terms of the climate science.
Absolutely. Well, I think we can, on that note, what we should say is right before we had the interview, I made a pitch to people if they wanted to get us on their local radio station, to contact their local radio station. I'll add one more further to that. If you read an article about the climate change or any environmental topic that just drives you bonkers, email the person who wrote it and ask them to have either Mark or I comment on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Good idea.
Absolutely. Mark, it was an absolute pleasure to have you on again. I'm sorry it's been so long since we've spoken. If you want to just tell people how to get in contact with you again, that would be really great. It was great having you on again today.
Yeah, sure. And I look forward to working with you some more, Darren. People can check out my website, the show website, which is earthgage.ca. Pretty easy to remember. The show is called Earth Gage Radio, and the website is earthgage.ca. You can email me at earthgageradio@gmail.com. And I look forward to working with you some more in the future, Darren.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Mark.